My name is Thomas. I work at Red Hat. I'm going to be very hoarse after this. So this talk is sort of a sideshow to the Project Lilliput. Roman talked about that earlier. When we were working on Project Lilliput in the last couple of years, we had to shrink the narrow class ID down to 22 bits, as Roman has explained. And in the course of that work, we saw that we may hit at some point in time limits in the class space model we have now. So last summer I set out to explore some alternative avenues, and that's the talk basically. So you have to remember the class space has been with us since its inception, basically since Pangan removal, and it's fraying around the corners, it's showing its age. And sometimes it's good to step back and look what you are doing, whether you should be continue doing it, or whether there are alternatives and whether the trade-off still makes sense, even if you end up doing the same in the end. So a small recap. Class space. Objects live in the heap, obviously. And if the GVM wants to do something with an object, it needs to know things about that object. And many of these things are recorded in the class structure. The class structure, written with Captain K, is a native data structure in metaspace or class space. It's two sides of the same coin, really, and contains things like iTable, VTable, OOPMap, and so on. So every object contains a reference to the class of its class. And the shape of this reference matters because it has to be small. It goes into every object. So every byte matters. And decoding has to be fast because we do this all the time, especially during GC. Now, we could just put a raw pointer into the header. We don't do that because it's a bit silly and it wastes memory, at least on 64-bit. On 32-bit, we do that. What we do instead, there is a mode actually in the GVM. You can enable this if you switch off. You need to deliberately switch off compressed class pointers, and then you have this mode. But I actually think this mode shouldn't exist anymore. We should deprecate it. What we instead do by default is a trade-off between size and decoding speed. We have the so-called narrow class ID or narrow class pointer. The narrow class pointer is a 32-bit offset of the address of the class structure, which refers to a common base, which we add, and then you have the class pointer. There's also an optional shift of 3, which I will ignore for now because it's basically not used anymore, at least not in practical concerns, because it doesn't work with CDS and everyone runs with CDS. So using this technique means that you have a 4 GB range, so you have to confine the location of all class structures to a 4 GB range or the offset will flow over. And we do that. That starts at the encoding base, and in this encoding range we place CDS and class space. And all classes live in that thing. And the distance, the pointer difference between the class structure and the encoding base is the narrow class ID we put into the object. And this technique allows us, this is actually pretty smart, because this technique allows us to translate a narrow class ID into the real class pointer without any additional loads. We can just, it's one load to load the narrow class ID. Everything else can happen on the CPU, because at least from the point of the JIT, the encoding base is a constant. So we can encode it directly in the instruction stream as some form of immediate, which we do. With Lilliput, things change a bit. So the narrow class ID shrunk down to 22 bits and moved into the mark word, as Roman has explained. You can see an advantage of Lilliput right here, because now we can load both mark word and the narrow class ID in a single 64-bit load, and that actually shows in metrics. That's one of the advantages, one of the many advantages. And 22-bit give you only a coverage of 4 megabyte, and that would be a small class space. So what we do instead is we now have an obligatory shift of 10. The reality is a bit more complex, so the shift can be smaller, but let's go with 10. And every narrow class ID now is shifted by 10. In effect, this means that every class structure has to be located at an address that is 1 kilobyte aligned. So we have an alignment jitter of 10 bits, which we then just don't save. And that works. So we ship Lilliput. We will ship Lilliput for JDK21. It works. The only problem is now there are two disadvantages. The first, so what you can see is we impose a cadence of sort, like 1 kilobyte cadence on the encoding range. Every class structure lives there and only there, unless you don't want to decode the pointer. And first thing is obvious, you now have alignment waste. Every class structure is followed by a block of memory of variable size. Class structure is variable sized. And we cannot use this memory for class structures. So we solve this problem by using recycling this memory for data that would otherwise be live somewhere else. So the net footprint is not zero. The net footprint loss is zero. And that data it's also metadata. It belongs. It has the same lifetime scope as a class, so it's fine. This really works. So that problem is solved. The other problem, however, is the problem of hyperaligning, and I will come to that. So why should we change? There are several reasons. Apart from the hyperaligning issue, we have a class limit we are sneaking up on. Every further step, for instance, for Lilliput, will reduce the narrow class ID. And the size of the narrow class ID is really the class limit. It's not the size of the class space, but it's the size of the bit size of the narrow class ID. So with Lilliput, we are now at 4 million, and it goes down, and it gets tight. It's not a problem yet, so it's not really urgent problem. What we need to have a plan, and we have a plan, and I will present that plan at the end. The problem is that narrow class ID setup, CDS and class-based decoding setup is really complex, and it's not fun complex. It's annoying complex. It's brittle and maintenance heavy. So we have lived with this problem for quite some while. This code exists for 15 years. We can continue to live with it. But if the opportunity arises to not have a class base, this would be good. We could reduce a lot of complexity, honestly. The setup's complex for a number of reasons. Unfortunately, when I was preparing this, I had like six slides, and I don't have time for that. FOSDEM talks are short. So suffice to say, there is a basic problem behind all them. And the basic problem is that the numerical shape of the narrow class ID and of the encoding base is tightly coupled with allocator mechanics, because the narrow class ID is in part of an address. And that address is the product of an allocator, the metaspace allocator. And that one does allocator things, like it has a body allocator in the middle, it does free list management, and so on. So it's already kind of hard to predict and influence the shape of the narrow class ID, if you want to do that, and we maybe want to do that. Next thing is, below the allocator, there is a virtual memory layer, and below that is the operating system. So in the end, eventually, we have mmap calls to the operating system. And the operating system, we are subject to the whims of the operating system, like address space population and ASLR and whatnot. And so if you want to do things like you want to have a certain bit shape of the encoding base, maybe because your particular JIT or your particular ISA struggles with representing arbitrary 64-bit immediates, then you need to fight this out with the allocator and with the underlying OS. And it's important to remember that this is a performance trade-off. We do things the way we do because they are fast. There is a simpler way, and I will present one. So the hyperaligning problem. Class structures are aligned to 10 bits. That's fine. So it works. But the problem is now with a typical cache line size of 64 byte, we lose 4 bit for selecting a cache line. And that means we have more cache thrashing now. If you walk the heap and you touch different class structures, you have a higher chance of evicting the other class structure. We didn't know, Roman and I, we knew that this effect existed. We didn't really have time to focus on it because Lilliput really needed our attention elsewhere. And clearly, SPECGBB, if you, Roman didn't really touch on that topic, but Lilliput brings a lot of positive effects also in terms of memory bandwidth, very much so. So clearly, whatever effects the hyperaligning had is much more than outweighed by the positive effects of Lilliput, because things in the heap are now smaller, and you can basically, you use your memory bandwidth much more efficiently. Still, question is, how much better could we be? And now, last summer I set aside some time to look at this, and first I tried a couple of general purpose benchmarks. The problem here is that general purpose benchmarks, not always, but most of the time, they tend to drone out whatever you want to measure with general mutator and VM noise. And so this was getting me nowhere. And then I was at a junction of some sort. I could say, okay, you don't see anything in general purpose benchmark, you can just forward with a class space. And I wasn't really daring to do that. There were actually people who said this. But the problem here is always you as a GVM vendor, you never know who's using your stuff. I mean, you never can be sure whether a significant portion of the user base will be hurt by a change. And there are existing optimizations in the GVM which seem to indicate that this is kind of important. So what I did was I wrote a small micro benchmark in order to mimic the behavior, the situations in which these optimizations are important. The thing is rather simple. You populate the heap with a ton of objects. The objects try to mimic the distribution of object features in a realistic population in a way, like distribution object sizes, distribution of UPMAP sizes, and so on. But they belong to a randomly selected class of a set of n classes. And clearly, when you have the larger the set, this has been the benchmark parameter, the larger the set, the more adverse the cache effects when you trace the heap, because you touch different classes. Also clearly, the higher the number of classes, the more unrealistic it gets, because heap population is rarely like this. But it really exposes like bad cache behavior very well. So I tried in non-power 2 alignment. This is a very simple idea. So you make the class alignment not a power 2 value, but a non-power 2 value. More specifically, you take an uneven number of cache line sizes. In my case, I just hard-coded 11, 704 bytes. This means if you touch different classes, you touch different cache lines, eventually every cache lines. So it's nicely distributed. The decode is not an add and shift anymore. It's an add and an integer multiplication. But this is only like three more cycles, depending on the CPU. But I have to say, while I was writing it, I was already kind of hating this patch, because dealing with non-power 2 alignment is no fun. It's really awkward. So the results are interesting. So the level 1 misses the rise similarly steeply. Blue is the prototype. Black is stock. The level 1 misses rise similarly steeply, but they start at a later stage. So then I thought, okay, this I can work with this. Now I have numbers. Now I know how much hyperaligning costs. And this because everything else was the same. I didn't really like this patch, though. It has a second problem, which is that deep within Metaspace, we have a power 2-based body style allocator, and that doesn't... If you throw allocation sizes at it that are large, because class is large, and with alignment requirements that are not power 2 based, it starts choking. So you have fragmentation. This can be solved. I know I can solve this, but the problem at that point, I was kind of meh. I have something. I can do it, and it's fine, you know, if nothing else it works. So the next alternative is a class pointer and direction table. Very quickly, the idea comes up over and over again. Colleen Fillimore from Oracle brings this up. And the idea here is that we don't have a class space. What we do is we just place pointers into a lookup table, and every narrow class ID is the slot of the lookup table. Two advantages. First, no class space, lots of fewer complexities. This is really good. It solves hyperaligning as an excellent almost, because now the class structure can live wherever, so they can be aligned wherever. whatever. Big disadvantage is now you have one more load in a hot decode path. And this shows. So steeper rise, we can clearly see with Lilliput that first we have a benefit because a hyperalignment is avoided, and then it goes into pivots into negative territory, where and then it just goes progressively worse. So this was already not good, obviously. So on this point, the cost for the load outweighed the benefits of the avoided hyperaligning. And for non-Lilliput, of course, you don't have a benefit. You only have the cost. So it's bad, it's worse from the beginning. And the thing is, this approach only makes sense if you do it for Lilliput and non-Lilliput, because otherwise you don't have a complexity benefit. It's just only more complicated than what we already do. You can, the number of level one loads goes up flat by 5%. This is the load. So, okay. I didn't like this reader. I actually like this a lot. I would love to get rid of the class base, but I think it's too expensive, at least for now. So, and then I was getting impatient. I didn't have time anymore. And so I tried something different. I looked at how we actually access metadata during OOP iteration. So OOP iteration is when the GC traces a heap. He looks at an object, tries to figure out where reference are, and then traces these, and maybe does things with the object. So it goes, it loads a narrow class ID, then it decodes. Now we have the class pointer, now we know where the class structure is. Now it loads a ton of data from the class structure, it's distributed all over the class structure. And so we hit, we don't always load everything, but we load at least the OOP map, and that one is at the end of a variable size section, so we need to figure out where that one is. And it's a ton of loads from different cache lines, up to 7 different cache lines I count, if I count correctly. And as an added malus, the class structure is large, so you will never hit the same cache line from one class to the other. So that is kind of, can we do this better? Turns out we can. So the new approach I played around with was you when you load a class, you pre-compute a little token, a 32-bit token. And that token contains all the information I need for OOP iteration. And that seems weird because that's a lot of information. That's like 70 bytes. How do we get into 4 bytes? But we get. The point here is that this compression doesn't have to always work. It's an optimization. If it doesn't work, it's still in the class structure. You look in the class space. So, but it has to work for most cases to make it worthwhile. But in Java, most objects are small and simple. So they have a small instance size and very few OOPMap entries, really. So the patch works this particular thing. If the instance size can be statically computed, which is always the case, unless it's a Yavalan class instance or something like that. Instance size smaller than 512 bytes, and the number of OOPMap entries is less than 3. And if we were loaded by one of the 3 loaders, then we get a bonus. And turns out this works for like 96 to 99% of all objects in a given heap population. And I did a ton of different tests with different applications like SpecPGBB and JackBrains and so on. So this actually turns out to work well. There's a little trick involved for those who wonder about the OOPMap thing. So OOPMaps describe where in the objects are referenced to other objects. And if you load a normal object, then you have the GVM clusters the object references. So for normal, simple objects, you only have a single OOPMap entry. You only get multiple OOPMap entries when you now have a child of this parent class, because the part of the parent class is now immutable. But what you can do is, like for every hierarchy level in this hierarchy, when you build up the class in the field layouter, we can just alternate the order between OOPs and non-OOPs. And now you have, this is like 10 lines of code, and now you have a higher chance of OOP sections ending up neighboring each other, and then the GVM will just create a single OOP map entry. That's how we get the average number of OOP maps down, OOP map entries. So the rest is simple. We store this thing into a side table. That side table I call clued, class lookup table, and the index into that thing is the narrow class ID. And iteration now looks like this. We load the narrow class ID from the object, and we don't need to decode, no decode needed. So what we do, we load the token from the clued, And then we are done. The token contains all information I need for iteration. I need some bit fiddling to get it out, but it can happen all in CPU, no third memory load, if you disregard the memory load of the CLOOP base. And that's just two loads from two different cache lines. And there is actually a very good chance of different loads hitting the same cache line, because 16 tokens fit into a single cache line. So results, the matrix look a lot better. The red line down there is CLOOD. So you can see that the response to a rising number of classes, level one misses, is a lot flatter. And not only that, we also have we have much lower number of level three loads. And both of them together means that you do much fewer loads than before. And it's like 50 to 60% fewer loads. And of those loads that actually happen, most of them are satisfied by the level one cache, or a lot more than with the other approaches. So I think this handily solves the hyper-aligning issue we had, and over-solves this really. So this works very well. GC pauses go down in the micro. They went down for all of them, but include the best. And I was happy to see that if you squint real hard, you can actually see some metrics in SPECGBB to go down. There's a grain of salt though, since the standard deviation is 5 to 7%. The standard deviation for the micros was like 1%. So here, this has definitely to be confirmed and more measurements, but it at least gives me hope. So for me, the conclusion, this is the best performance of all by far. It's not that complex, so because it just replaces the old iteration, so it's fine. And the important part here is that actually complements Colleen's idea with the indirection table very good, because that idea with the indirection table suffers from poor decoding speed because of the load. But if you don't decode, who cares? Of course, this is only for OOP iteration done in C++, but maybe we can adjust this for other things. So CLOOD first. I would love to bring CLOOD in. I think there is no argument against it, and then maybe the indirection table thing. At least it's interesting. And then maybe in the end we don't have a class base. Then goodbye class base after 15 years. Okay, very quick. Running out of time, completely different topic, of course. The number of classes is limited by the narrow class ID. Today, stock JVM, 5 to 6 million limit. Lilliput brings us down to 4. Hypothetical Lilliput 2 with 90-bit class, we are now at 512K. Things get tight. Even if you don't have Lilliput 2, you might at some point in time, there's always the thing that you may want to repurpose narrow class pointer bits for something else because the mark word gets smaller. And there is a plan. We have a plan for this, and this is actually very cool. The plan is not from me, but from John Rose at Oracle. And it's the near class, far class idea. Basically, the idea here is that you have near classes, which are normal classes, and you have the narrow class ID as described. But if you hit the limit, what a narrow class ID can represent, you have some way to do this by offloading, injecting the class pointer into the middle of the object. The specific of that idea on this mailing list, and you can read it up. And I kind of hope maybe if I get time to implement a prototype next year, because at least so that we know it works and that we also can measure how much it costs. Lastly, thanks Roman, and thanks Colleen and Stefan in absence. Working on Lilliput has been really fun, and yeah, I'm actually done. Thank you. Okay.